Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And a train's coming. Does it ever cross your mind just to like jump in front of the train? Yes, my child. Exorcism is booming at the moment. Yeah. Like last year it was fidget spinners. This year it's the ancient ritual of exorcism. Start spreading the news, all this sort of crap. There was big money involved. I thought I could win a big pot of cash. Spit on the Bible and, you know, God is, God sucks and way! Hello, you're listening to the award-winning Weird Tales and the Unexplainable. This is Bob Shoy, and with me, as usual, my good friend Beef.
Hey, you're right.
And this week, no Tiss. But we have hopefully a worthwhile replacement for him.
Oh, he's a better replacement than Tiss.
So we have the author and podcaster and reverend.
Yes, my child.
As well as many other things, Peter Laws.
Yeah, hello. It's good to be with you.
Very pleased to have you with us. We spoke to you ages ago about trying to organise this, and then things got in the way, and you know we got new jobs and moved around.
Yeah, I can't remember when I first met you. Was I speaking at a conference?
Me and Tiss went to. I think it was in Reading. I don't know why I'm looking at you. You wasn't there.
Yeah, I couldn't. But I was away.
Like a really kind of small pokey hotel.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Does God believe in ghosts? That's what I was talking about.
Because was during, that the title of your seminar?
I think it was. Yeah, but you guys weren't able to be there because you would only be there like one.
Yeah, we had to leave like super early, and then we got stuck in traffic, so we might as well have not left anyway. So it's really annoying.
It's all flooding back now.
Yeah, we saw like the first three talks, then had to leave, which was annoying because there was some really good stuff later in the day. But yeah, that was like a few years ago. At the beginning of the day, I think I was sat like next to you.
Yeah,
so we got chatting about like podcasting and stuff.
Yep.
And now we're here. Yeah. Like 2 years later.
So you were nice and quick.
It's like it's nice meant and efficient. To be.
Yeah.
Written in the stars.
Absolutely.
So a couple of years ago now, episode, I'm going to get the number exact because that's what I like to do. Oh. Episode number 41.
Show off.
We had Dan along with us. Mm. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was a great episode.
And we talked about fear as like one of our discussion episodes. And seeing as Peter's written a book all about like, what frightens us, the frighteners available now.
Yeah.
Doing it for you.
Good books.
Yeah. So we thought it'd be interesting to revisit that kind of topic and, cause Peter knows a lot more about it than us.
Yeah. I mean, so just to kind of give you an idea, we spoke to, a good friend of mine, Dan, who was at the same church as me. They've now planted another church in Gloucester. If you're new to the pod or you've only listened to a few episodes here and there, as a few of you do, then please go back to episode 41 and listen to our episode on fear. But we talked about the philosophy of fear and what we're scared of and a whole bunch of other stuff. It was a good show.
It was really fun. We spent a long time talking about phobias, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just went on that tangent. Do you have any phobias?
I don't have any full-on phobias. I mean, I certainly have things that scare me more than others. But I wouldn't say I have a full-on actual phobia. I know C.S. Lewis had a phobia of insects when he was a kid. Yeah. And he used to be really freaked out by like locusts and those sorts of things. He kind of described them as being horrible, kind of demonic monsters. And for him, he said that was something that really spilled over into this sort of the phobia that was just a horrible experience for him.
Right.
I kind of share that sense, like insects particularly. Mm-hmm. I find them really quite distressing.
I'm not keen on insects myself.
No, I think, I've said on the pod a few times, spiders for me. And I wouldn't say I'm absolutely terrified of them. I just don't like them. And I think...
Your wife said that you, like, get all...
I have to name them. If I name them, then they're all right.
Yeah. My wife last night, right? This morning she woke up and said, "Did you know about the drama last night?" I was like, "What drama?" And she said she reached over in the middle of the night and she picked up her glass of water to drink, like, you know, almost a blind drink it because it was pitch black. Oh. And Daddy Long Legs had fallen inside it and she went inside her mouth.
That's horrible.
So she's spitting it all out. And then this morning she woke up telling me that what had happened and she looked for the dead body of the Daddy Long Legs. Could be found and found a little piece of paper foil that had fallen in.
Oh,
okay. So her brain had filled in the gaps.
Anything when it's dark like that, the things your brain does fill in the gaps with are scary.
Yeah,
because do you even like put your feet at the bottom of the covers, or is that an issue for you? Because then a lot of people won't have their feet at the bottom exposed in case something like...
No, I used to. When I was a kid...
Essentially touch your feet then.
We were talking earlier about films we watched when we were kids.
Yeah.
And I remember watching... We did like a horror movie marathon all night. And then I was absolutely petrified to have anything outside of the duvet. So just my head outside. And even that was quite scary. I'm like, well, something might pull me under the bed and eat me.
Well, it's just the darkness, isn't
it? I find that I will do things, though, that will try and accentuate the fear and kind of play around with the fear. Right. So it might be an example like, I know one weekend we had a rat problem in our last house. Right, and we weren't sure how many rats we had in this problem, but we were waking up in the morning and we were finding like loaves of bread were vanishing and they were being dragged behind the fridge. Was it a poltergeist or was it a rat? We didn't know. So it turned out it was a rat. It was at least one rat. And
it's a disappointment.
At least one. Yeah.
It turns out it was a poltergeist.
It was a very hungry rat.
Yes. And so my wife like went away for the weekend, took the kids away because apparently it's not very healthy because one of my kids had sort of chicken pox at the time. Yeah. Apparently that's not a good combo. No. But for the weekend that I knew that there was rats in the house, and I don't really like rats, I thought, well, this is the perfect weekend to sit in almost in the near dark and read The Rats in the Walls by H.P. Lovecraft.
Really accentuating.
So I just thought, oh, cool, like the atmosphere will be even better. I remember when I was a kid and I would read Stephen King novels or H.P. Lovecraft or whatever, and I would tend to sit up on my windowsill and keep the window open and switch all the lights off so I could only read it by the street lamp, or watching horror films where I'd go, if I deliberately open the back door, if it's a film about a killer or something, if I keep the back door open throughout this film, it will give that added little frisson.
So much praise. He's making it like four-dimensional.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Like 4DX cinema for cheap.
4D before its time.
Yeah. But that's amazing. But that's playing with like fears in a playful way which you're in control of. You know, you can shut the door. And that's what I find interesting about fear or the morbid or the macabre. That's it. That it's something that actually you can utilize and get power over it. So that's what I like doing. That doesn't mean then that I would actually like to be attacked by a real killer in my house. No. It's completely different. And I also wouldn't necessarily like to be covered in rats for real. But that area in between where it's a possibility but probably won't happen.
Yeah.
That's exciting. I find that exciting. It's fearful, but it's exciting.
I think I get that. I think I remember watching, we were away, we used to go away as a whole family with my grandparents and aunts and uncles and usually down to like an old country house in Devon or Cornwall or something like that. And, I remember staying up one night and watching TV and Misery was on.
Oh yeah.
And had no idea what it was. No idea. It was an adaptation of one of the most famous horror books in the world. And I guess because the setting for that is very isolated, the house is away from everything. I was watching it. I suddenly became very aware. I'm isolated. This house is away from, you know, it felt so real.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that is kind of a scary movie because, the actress's name,
Kathy Bates.
She does such a great job of playing that character. It is a scary movie, but it was more fun, I guess, because like you say, you kind of have the power to control that fear a little bit and keep it teetering on the edge a bit.
It's interesting that a lot of people would like modify things to like lessen the fear. Like, yeah, they'll turn the light
open
on,
the curtains.
Yeah, something like that. But
yeah, watch you're it
doing
with
the
people.
You're doing the complete opposite. You're like exacerbating the fear. You want it.
Yes, definitely.
Like you're a fear junkie.
And yeah, and I was like, turn the volume up just slightly too loud.
Yeah, yeah.
So that when the big jump scares kick in, it will give you a fright. But the interesting thing is, even though I'm a fear junkie, but only in a very soft way, because I'm not a kind of extreme sports type of guy. I wouldn't jump out of an aeroplane. Mm. I wouldn't sort of do a bungee jump, that sort of stuff. I'm more about like the kind of psychological adventure of fear. That's what I tend to like. But I learned a bit about fear last year when I did this thing with the BBC, this documentary about Meet the Humans and about why people are drawn to fear. And me and a bunch of other people were kind of blind driven to this old spooky mansion in the middle of nowhere. Wow. Where we were greeted by this like one-eyed butler and a witch and they took us into this thing and there's like cameras all over the place and they basically exposed us to kind of scary situations throughout the weekend, and we'd had kind of psychological evaluation beforehand, quite intensive evaluation, where they were asking us what things you're scared of, and I'd said I'm scared of pretty scared of insects and those sorts of things. And so they did kind of design bespoke things for us to be scared of. But the insect thing was interesting because we had dinner on the evening. We'd had all sorts of crazy things happening. We had dinner on this evening and all the dinner was normal. I thought it was going to be like, you know, Bush Tucker trial style. You know,
I was waiting for you to say something.
And I assumed that's what it would be. And they came out at the end and they brought out, you know, I don't know what you call them, those big sort of silver covers that you put over dessert. Right. It's got a proper name. I don't know
what they're called.
And you have to look that up. And they put that in the middle and I thought, oh, here we go. We're going to have to, you know, eat a bull's testicle or something. And they pulled that off and it was filled with spiders, and all these spiders ran across the table and kind of leapt upon us, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was really fascinating because I am scared of these sorts of things, but there was a woman there, a horror writer, like who writes for magazines and stuff, and she is the most extreme person when it comes to enjoying horror and scare experiences. And she's done some crazy stuff, but I've never seen anyone as petrified because she has a proper phobia of spiders.
Right. Wow.
She was in the corner shaking to such an extent she couldn't move anymore. And what happened was, like, as soon as there was someone else in the room who was worse than me, that filled me with courage. And I just thought, okay, so I'm not the most fearful person. And so her fear prompted me to go up and try and grab one of these spiders, which I wouldn't normally do. And so it can depend on who you're with.
That's really interesting.
The levels of fear you have. And so if you're frightened of something, you kind of try and hang out with someone who's more frightened than you are, and it will boost your courage.
Well, I find that if you watch a horror film of someone else, I just presume that everyone's braver than me.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Okay.
So when I watch it with play a video game with someone else in the room, watch a film with someone else in the room, if they're getting scared, I'm like, well, Mr. Brave is getting scared, but I'm all right here, sort of thing. Yeah, and it makes me feel sort of more confident.
Definitely.
Yeah. If I watch a horror film on my own, I could get freaked out. If I watch it with like Becca, it's all right. Cause I know she's going to be scared as well. It goes the other way. Yeah. I know she's going to be scared. So I'm like, don't worry, darling.
Well, I remember telling you when I played The Last of Us 5 years ago.
Oh, The Last of Us, yeah, it's a good game.
Oh, man, my favourite game of all time. It was a great game. But I remember pretty much the scariest part of that game when you're kind of creeping around in the hotel trying to find your way out, and you're not with Ellie. She's been trapped somewhere else. Mm. And I was really scared. It's horrible. It's a really horrible part of the game because you're plunged into darkness. You've got the zombies running around and you can hear them and you can't, you know, where they are.
Yeah, there's no light. You've got to get the generator going because you can't see anything.
Oh, great. Generator's going to make noise and light and attract them. Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. This is going to be awful.
Mm.
But Rachel then came in and she's like, oh, this looks horrible. Like, yeah, you need to stay here. And because she was a little bit scared, I kind of like, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to show her I can do this.
You're dead right. That's a very important part of fear and overcoming fear, is having a kind of community around you. And also how much fear can affect you when you are by yourself. I certainly learned that when I was writing this Frighteners book, because throughout this book, I was having loads of kind of scary experiences, you could say, but most of them involved other people, or, you know, it was me going get alongside other people who love frightening things. So that I found I was really quite bold during those things. Mm-hmm. But I did do one thing where I had to stay over in this kind of haunted hotel, and we were creeping around in the sort of, there was for a chapter on paranormal interest. And I went to bed that night and I stayed in a, I didn't realize I was in a room underneath where some woman had cut her throat in the bath. And at nighttime, I'd been so kind of charged all night by these ghostly stories. When I was with everybody else, I was like, yeah, let's go in the tunnel. Let's go and creep around. Yeah. The second I was by myself, the whole scenario changed because I was lying in bed thinking, crap, what happens if I see something? Like, how am I going to decide what's happening? You know, if I see a shadow in the corner or something speaks to me, if I'm with another person, I'm bold because I can say, Beef, is that, do you see that? And you say yes. And I go, oh, cool, I'm not crazy. Or if you say no, it's just a thing. And then like, oh, I'm misunderstanding, I'm misinterpreting. But the second you're by yourself, particularly in a paranormal situation, it complicates everything. And it means that your sanity is in question. So actually being by yourself is an amazingly potent opportunity to feel proper fear. I certainly found that, and I stayed over in a kind of, I wasn't allowed to talk about it in the book because it turned out there's a media embargo on this particular place, so I couldn't do it. I stayed over.
It was still fun.
It was pretty fun, but I stayed over in this very kind of haunted, notorious place for satanic worship, and I was there, and I was crapping myself, like, because I was there at like 1 a.m. by myself in the middle of nowhere, and I was like, man, I am actually, this is fear I'm not enjoying. So I suppose that's what I mean about when I say I need fear, but to certain levels. And then when it slips over into I'm not in control anymore, it becomes real fear with a capital F. But I still look back on the real fear with great nostalgia. I still go, that was a cool experience.
Yeah.
I'm glad I had that.
I think you're talking about community is really interesting. And I certainly level with you with the, you know, we want to talk to you about demonology and exorcisms and all kind of stuff. And I think there have been times where I've been with other people and maybe there's been some kind of demonic activity going on. And when you're with other people, you gain that strength from each other. And I think that's when the power over fear kind of comes in. But there have been occasions where I've been on my own and experienced something incredibly unsettling. And I would label it as like a demonic presence almost. It is potent. That word that you used is very apt.
Community
can be strong.
Yeah. And I suppose it could work the opposite way, where community can also increase fear when fear shouldn't be present. You know, you can have a situation where, I don't know, you could be in a situation with a group of people where everything is really quite okay. And yet when people start being frightened and overly frightened, it has a ripple effect and it causes panic. And that's why people stumble over each other and break each other's necks when they're trying to get out of stadiums or whatever.
There's
panic issues. But if you were on your own, you could have a more level head. So it can work both ways.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you find yourself cool under pressure, Beef? Like something scary happens with a group of people, are you going to start, everyone panic, everyone like get out of it, or are you like, okay,
no, I feel like I'm calm. I'm pretty calm. I think because of the nature of my job, where it is quite unpredictable. I'm working with people who, you know, with students who have all sorts of behavioral difficulties. So my days are pretty unpredictable anyway. But it depends on the nature. I think when I remember being in a car crash, it was such a weird, surreal experience. I remember I really did feel like time had basically stopped as it was happening. And I was able to basically plan what I was going to do. And it worked out that for that moment, I was then able to help my friend she was in a mess, in an absolute mess. I mean, obviously her car was pretty wrecked, but apart from that, she was, you know, just completely inconsolable. So I was able to then kind of help her out. I guess in that situation, yes, but not every time. I think it depends on the situation. I think so for Father's Day this year, my dad had built a soapbox and we were doing the soapbox derby in Aylesbury. It was great fun.
Like
it was really good.
Like a 50s American movie. That's
It was it was cool. It was really good. But my dad had asked me and my brother to drive, and I said, yeah, that sounds really fun. Yeah. I said, that's great. And then I went, you know, we went home and I was talking to Rachel about it. She's like, well, are you gonna do that? I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? It sounds fun. She went, what if you fall out? And I went, oh God, I might fall out. And then I got really scared. I got really worried about it.
And were you scared of the implications of how it would affect your life? Oh no, I've broken my wrist. I'll struggle with work or something. Or were you just thinking of the pure immediate?
Or the embarrassment pain. If someone got pressure.
I think it's the embarrassment. It was the because
it was.
It was yeah. because there were kids there doing, you know, riding theirs, and I thought, man, if I, I'd also, I think I was very aware of how much time my dad had spent building it and putting it together and all the love and energy it. And I thought, oh, I don't want to break it.
But funnily enough, right, even the embarrassment that a person can feel in a social situation can actually help them feel more focused. Sorry, less focused, and therefore they don't feel fear as much. At this BBC thing I did, there was one point where we did this experiment where I was in, we all were kind of told one by one to go into this spooky old Victorian bathroom where all these candles everywhere and all these weird puzzles, Victorian Gothic type puzzles we had to solve. And we all went in one by one, and most of us solved the puzzles fairly well. But then at the end of the puzzles, there was like a jump scare where this kind of freaky ghost came out of the mirror, right? And the ones who solved the puzzles well, including myself, jumped. And yet the two people who didn't jump were the people who didn't solve the puzzles well. And the conclusion was because they were so kind of preoccupied about, crap, do I look stupid? I messed up these things. That actually, when it came to a fear situation, they didn't flinch in the same way as we did because they were too caught up in the other emotions. So sometimes you'll feel fear more when you have the brain space to focus on it.
Yeah. That's one of them jump scare videos that you love so much are that are so successful because you're focusing, waiting for something to happen. They're distracting you. And then when your brain is focused, jump.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other side of that, one time I was in Amsterdam at the Amsterdam Dungeons.
Right. Obviously.
And two of us, of all the people, you have a guided tour.
Is that a brothel or is that an actual...
No.
It's not
the London
name.
Dungeons. But two of us, let's say we're intoxicated and everyone else wasn't. Mm-hmm. I'll say two of them were intoxicated and everyone else wasn't.
Right.
And there was this big jump scare at the end of this, tunnel thing that was all walking through, but everyone else screamed, and the two people who were just distant, intoxicated, were just didn't nothing phased them. They were just staring into space.
Yeah.
So it is about brain engagement.
Mm. Yeah,
fear,
absolutely.
And
the Dutch courage idea of having drink. It's purely because it's you're not concentrating as hard on what could go wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess maybe on the other hand, concentrating or having an idea of the bigger picture can maybe also help you grapple that as well, because I did an escape room near Milton Keynes, which was brilliant. You had to escape from a serial killer's.
Oh,
it was great, really, really good. The theming was really good fun.
That's great.
But partway through, you get jump scare stuff happening. I won't tell you exactly what because it'll spoil it. And so I was with seven other guys, and all of them, apart from me and this other guy, pooed their pants. But the guy, me and my friend were trying to put this puzzle together and work something out. And I guess because we were so involved in that, he hadn't even heard that there'd been something happen.
Right.
I was like, oh, it's all right, chill out. It's fine. We need to come on back here. Let's get this sorted. I think fear is such a powerful, powerful thing. But I think this is what we're talking about with Dan as well.
It's such a vast topic. That's why we've done two episodes on it now.
Have you played any VR horror?
I haven't. I don't have the metal to handle it.
Oh, okay, because that is surprisingly immersive. And again, it cuts out all the distractions. And so I was playing Resident Evil Biohazard last night.
Which is scary enough without...
But man, when you're in the whole zone and you're...
You did that VR?
Yes. I was playing that last night. You can only play it for so long before you want to puke up. So you have to take it in spurts. It's amazingly effective. Especially when you're kind of just turning around and then there's some sort of crazy woman in your face, stabbing your knees.
Yeah, because there's shocking stuff that happens in that game.
Yeah.
And it was kind of when I played it, because it's in first person as well, you kind of oh, I can't believe that happened in a game. I was shocked and scared or whatever.
Yeah.
Actually, in VR, you would really feel like that's happening to you.
Yeah, and you're leaning down and you're going, I think she's right there. And you're leaning over and actually looking through the windows. And you slow down to look at the environment because you're actually feeling you're in it.
Oh,
and that's the interesting thing about VR and horror VR. You kind of remember playing those games as if it was a place you were visiting rather than a game you were playing, which is actually pretty incredible. Mm. But the technology needs kind of sorting out in terms of stopping you throwing up all the time.
I love the idea of VR horror.
Yeah.
But I just don't think I could do it. I feel like as soon as I put it on, I'm like, no, never again. Never again.
I think after watching you play PT, mm-hmm. a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty scary.
I hated it. So I thought, well, I can't. And I remember playing the first Silent Hill.
Yeah.
And that was pretty scary to me as a, I don't know, I guess I would have been
about 10.
That
really scared me when that came out.
I was quite young.
Could have been young.
But I'd never played anything like that before. And it was actually, for a PS1 game, it was really atmospheric, wasn't it?
The first horror game that really played on the psychological aspects of horror, absolutely. Rather than just like something scary.
Yeah,
but the imagery was also pretty scary too.
But the, PT was too, I think I'm not, jump scares are not my thing.
No.
I just struggle with them.
Me neither, really.
It's, roller coaster's fine. No, I've done a skydive. That's fine.
Ah, right. Yeah, so I'm not as into that stuff.
Heroes.
But I can't, I wouldn't be able to do a bungee.
No?
No. Because when you're in a plane,
you're attached to something on that.
Yeah, but I was too high to comprehend, you know, you're just about to jump out. It looks like a map. It's so high.
Do you hear about that company who got in trouble because whenever people they were doing bungee jumps and just as your foot left the platform, they would shout, "No, not yet!"
Yeah.
wait, he's not tight! You'd just be dropping current. Oh, crap.
Yeah, that's not fair, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a bit too intense.
But then when you live, think of the amazing feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and this actually, I mean, nice segue. This is actually, one of the interesting things because, of course, you know, when you feel fear and have scary experiences, you do feel alive because you've triumphed over them. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing as when you're watching a horror film. Even when you're watching a horror film where, like, somebody getting chased down an alley and getting attacked, and at the end everyone's dead and there's one person surviving, you as the viewer, you're sitting there and you're actually sort of feeling, you're so immersed in the film for 2 hours, you come out feeling like you were also a survivor as well. Mm. And particularly if the people who are dying on screen are of your same demographic. Yeah. This is one of the interesting things about the audiences for horror films and other films that have death in them, is that they often match the demographic of the person who are dying in the film. So the people who tend to go and see war movies are young men, to watch young men getting shot. The people who go and see horror films like slasher movies, where women are getting chased through the woods, there's a high proportion of women who like to watch that stuff. And it's because we do actually quite enjoy seeing people like ourselves in utter peril and even getting killed. Because at the end, we're the ones who walk out and we say, well, we're alive.
Yeah.
That's actually quite a satisfying experience.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. I haven't really thought about that before.
It makes complete sense, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know you're like, we keep going back to horror films. And Peter, I know you're like a big like horror film sort of fan.
Yeah, I like horror films. Yeah, I'm a bit of a.
See, I like them, but I don't watch enough of them, and I never know which ones to watch.
More that I like.
Yeah, that's
because most of them now are so lazy. Well, they feel lazy. Like ones being made.
There's some good ones now, though.
I feel like maybe the proportion, maybe more quite low budget, and so
it's a cheap genre to make.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
However, I would really like to see, this is where you can kind of, this would be so suave if it was like perfectly edited, but the movie with John Krasinski.
Oh, Quiet Place.
Quiet Place, that's the one.
Oh yeah, did you see
it? I've not seen it, but I think to me
I thought it was overrated personally.
Oh really?
It's okay, but there's a lot, if you sit and think about that film logically, there is a heck of a lot of plot holes in it, but
right,
it was
probably,
I enjoyed watching it, but I just think so many people were saying it was like an absolute masterpiece.
I wonder if it's whenever it's something more I guess slightly more original, and I was thinking, you talking about demographics, that idea, although I'm not into horror movies, I was thinking I might go see that because it's about a guy with young kids. And so I guess maybe now the fear for me is anything happening to my son, so I guess that idea of scary.
It's amazing how your demographic, when it changes, that can affect how disturbed you'll be of things. And I guess it makes sense. But like, I remember before I had children, and if you're listening to this, by the way, out there, and you don't have kids, you don't have to have kids to care about kids. But I remember that for me, I always used to think horror films and thrillers like were copping out when they didn't let kids get killed in films,
right? Yeah,
because it'd be like, oh, here we go.
Of course, the kid's gonna
escape.
Yeah,
yeah. Like if the kid's dead body is in the woods, they'll lift up the sheet, but you won't actually see it. But you'll see all the adults. And I was thinking, this is unfair. This is prejudice. Blah blah blah. And then we had a kid. And I remember on the day we got back from the hospital, me and my wife thought, oh, should we watch a film, you know, to kind of like, like, you chill us out. And we watched, that Ben Affleck thriller is supposed to be good called Gone Baby Gone. Let's watch that. So we watched that, which is this really depressing film about a kid being kidnapped or whatever.
Right.
And we were watching it and I was like, I am so emotionally moved by this. It's just, I don't actually want to watch this anymore.
Yeah.
And I was like, the only thing that's changed is because I happen to have like my own kid in the house now. And so, yeah, you're right. It's amazing how, like, depending on what your life is, you know, you will be both drawn to things that will freak you out about it, but also they are much more potent in terms of depressing and disturbing you.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. When you started talking about that, I didn't know if you were going to talk about, I think it's just called Clown.
Oh, I don't know that.
Clown.
It's either The Clown or just Clown.
Right.
And the premise of the film is...
Is there a killer clown?
Well, kind of. It's a dad who adopts this clown persona for his kid's birthday party.
Right.
And he can't get the mask off after...
Oh, that's quite a good concept.
He ends up becoming this killer clown.
Right.
But the movie, what made it scary, I've not seen it, but what apparently made it scary to the people that told me about it, were the facts that he was killing kids and eating children in this film.
Ew.
Yeah, it's horrible,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But again,
you can't
it
get
crosses
a boundary
that
makes you a cannibal.
I'm
claustrophobic, so I'm restricted claustrophobia. So if I can't get something off, that's a panic to me. So yeah, I probably would start eating people off. I couldn't get
Wow. Man, don't ever wear a mask.
Yeah. Or like when you get a jumper stuck on your head, isn't that?
Yeah, that's real panic stations for me. Like you get your arm caught in a jumper trying to get it off.
Yeah.
Game over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I suppose like people sometimes ask me like, well, what's the scariest horror film you've ever seen? And I can list films that are scary. But I tend to find there's a common thread in films that I find affecting and disturbing, and it tends to be ones where the main character, you can't tell if the events are in their head or if it's real.
Okay,
and that's
a
recurring theme for me. I find there's a Roman Polanski movie called Repulsion, which I think is a brilliantly scary film. But that's just about a woman who's gradually going insane and seeing weird hands coming out the wall. Or is she actually experiencing some sort of demonic attack? You just don't know.
Well, a massive fear for yourself is like, sometimes you think, am I going mad?
Yeah.
And that's terrifying feeling. If anyone's ever had that, like, you feel like you're going insane.
Yeah.
That's terrifying. So the idea that you could be, or watching someone else go through that, you can relate.
Mm.
And it's like, the idea of losing your mind is just the most terrifying feeling.
I think. It is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I used to be a youth worker before I was a pastor. I was a youth pastor. And I remember one night we having this kind of like youth sleepover thing, and we were all like sort of at the church doing this kind of all night with games and stuff. And then at one point we were just sitting down talking, and for some reason we started talking about like what weird things we think about when we're out and about. And it was really interesting because I just kind of was happy to admit. I said, oh, like, does anyone else, you know, if you're near a railway line and a train's coming, does it ever cross your mind just to like jump in front of the train? And a few of the people were like, yes. And another person says, well, sometimes when I'm, you know, in a high building, I feel like I'm going to jump off. Or if I'm in an exam, you know, I feel like I want to get up on the table and scream and do crazy things. And what had happened was when we talked about this, these guys were saying, but I've always thought that was a sign that I was potentially either insane or, because of the Christian context, I was thinking that that was some sort of demonic attack.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And that gave it much more weight. And so they were thinking, crap, am I actually suicidal? Do I want to kill myself? And I just think that's just our brains are filled with images, and sometimes they come up with interesting things.
Yeah.
And I think it's perfectly natural to sort of just be driving along, and you just the thought might cross your mind, I suppose if I wanted to, I could drive this car straight into that other car.
Yeah.
That's interesting, I suppose, but I would never ever do it.
I have the power to do that.
Yeah.
Like have this massive disruption on this part of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could change someone's life completely and you'd never do it. I mean, the second you do it, that's when it becomes problematic, obviously.
Yes.
But what I find really interesting and kind of worrying is that there's a lot of people, particularly in the Christian church out there, who just sometimes have these random dark thoughts. And yet they're living in a kind of environment in which they're told, well, look, that you are under some sort of demonic oppression. Or you're simply...
You've got a demon.
You've got a demon. Or you probably are suicidal for thinking that.
Mm.
And nobody says that out loud. Nobody says, oh, well, I sometimes think about that. So I found a big liberation in sitting with other people and saying, what freaky things do you think about? It's amazing what other people will say, and they'll go, actually... And I interviewed some people for the book, like a literary agent who says, well, to be honest, sometimes sometimes like I'm in the tube station, I just feel like getting my laptop and smacking it off someone's head.
Yeah.
But yeah, she doesn't.
It's yeah. It was absolutely. I really see that makes me think of The Dice Man, the book by.
Oh yes, yeah.
Is it Luke Reinhardt?
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you. And I think it's the idea that actually our lives can sometimes be so mundane and we often don't feel like we have the power over our own lives because we have to go to work to pay the bills to do this, blah, blah, blah. That eventually you're just like, I could just, you know, and I used to think, I'd be waiting for a bus or something. And if an old person walked past, I was like, I could kick them in the road.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I'm not obviously not going to.
Yeah.
But I could. And you think, you're like, oh wow, what would happen if I actually did that?
Yeah.
And it's just your brain taking on a wild.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's your brain just getting a bit bored.
Yeah.
And thinking.
Yeah. Well, your brain is notoriously interested in novel experiences. Yeah. And that's why, you know, if you're in school and the lessons are boring, but then if the teacher comes in, like for little kids, and he brings in like a skull of a rat or something, and they'll go, look, kids, let's learn about rats. People are like, oh my word, this is interesting, because it's so novel. So your brain is really hungry for novelty. And we actually live in a very peaceful society. People seem to think we're getting worse and worse, but actually we're getting better and better in terms of levels of violence and level of education and all that stuff. So you could almost say we're living in a golden age, even though it might not seem like it. So so most of the people listening to this podcast, they're probably not worried about getting stabbed in the street or getting attacked. Some might be, but most probably aren't. And therefore, these experiences of horror, death, and scary stuff are really novel. And so it's really not a surprise to find that as a culture, we are drawn to explore these subjects because they are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're novel. So therefore, your brain wants to know about them.
Mm.
So yeah. Have you always found yourself like interested in this stuff, like your entire life? You've just like as a kid, you're into scary stuff.
I think so. But I suppose it's helpful to point out that it's just part of my personality.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, like growing up, I would love Knight Rider and the A-Team and all these kind of normal things.
Yeah.
I still like all that sort of stuff now. Science fiction, I'll happy watch a rom-com. I don't, you know, I'm quite open-minded with it. Things, but there was always something about horror and mystery that really drew me from stories of the paranormal and the unexplained to just straight up scary films, because I found that particularly for horror, I found horror was the only genre that took the supernatural seriously. Whereas when I was growing up, I mean, even though I'm a kind of ordained minister now and stuff, that's not where I expected to be. My early 20s is when I became a Christian, but up until then I was really quite anti-religion and anti-Christianity. I was in a band for a while called Creatures of the Night.
Where I was really hoping you'd be on Creatures of the Night. I love that.
Yeah, Creatures of the Night. That was a crazy band. And we were singing songs. I was writing songs about, you know, the Bible, spit on the Bible and, you know, God sucks. And, you know, and just wanting to push the boat out in terms of offensiveness. And there was, I remember at one point I found out that the local church had a Bible study group. And so, whereas me and my friends would go down in a classic kind of from the Northeast, I don't know if this is like what it's like anywhere else, but we'd go down the woods and like drink cooking sherry and do the classic rites of passage stuff. I guess that was normal up there.
You know? I think people do that down here as well.
Yeah,
it's just fun.
And so, but we would go out drinking, do those sorts of things. And then I would go, right, I know where this Christian Bible studies. I'm just going to turn up really drunk and just walk in, and they're probably going to be nice and let me in, which they did. And we'll just sit there and kind of rip into them about their faith. At some points, I remember a couple of times I kind of left. I'd deliberately pre-written some scary notes as if I was from a local cult who wanted to try and wipe out Christians. And I just stuffed it down their sofas so that one day they would go, oh my word, we're marked. It was ridiculously
this house is cursed.
Yeah, it was ridiculously stupid stuff, and it was bizarre because I was really quite a nice guy, unless a Christian was in the room and it really antagonized me. But even though Christians were trying to get me to convert, if you will, I never took them seriously. But horror did something different. Horror told me that what happens if the supernatural is real? What happens if there's such a thing as objective good and evil? What happens if there is something after death? These sorts of questions are quite fundamental. Oh, and also reminded me that death was real. Because it's very easy when you're a teenager to act as if you're invincible.
Mm.
But then horror does this really helpful wisdom, which says, oh, by the way, you can get like punched by a guy in a nightclub and die.
Yeah.
Which is pretty bleak. But it's actually quite helpful to know this. And that, a combination of those things and watching films like The Exorcist or whatever, actually were part of my spiritual awakening. I find that ironic that actually horror was my doorway into thinking spiritually. Whereas loads of Christians I know would say it's the thing that is trying to pluck people away from God. I found quite the opposite.
Mm. That's really interesting. I was going to ask how you became a Christian. Because I think maybe less and less now, actually, but definitely when I was younger, anyone that I knew that was a Christian was from a Christian family. And actually now in my church, I'd say most of the people in my age group, that was not the case at all. Lots of them grew up very similar to you, having no interest in faith at all.
Yeah.
So was it, kind of take us a bit more down that story, if you wouldn't mind. How did that then become from you to then deciding, actually, so this is now going to become my faith and now I'm going to commit my life to this?
That's a good question. I suppose when I was just starting at university, I'd had a couple of friends die in some not pleasant circumstances. And that kind of did make me think more about deeper questions, but I never really saw Christianity as an answer to those things. Mm. And so when I went to university, I remember I went to join the occult society because I thought, oh, cool. Well, I'll like learn about weird esoteric stuff, like spiritual things that way. But on that day, it cost £10 to join the occult society. I only had £5. So I joined the science fiction society instead. So during that first term, I remember I wasn't really like a particularly kind of great with commitment with girls and all that sort of stuff. I was pretty kind of like a ladies man type person. And I was kind of had been. And then one night I met this girl and I just really, really thought, flip and heck, she's like, she's amazing. I would go out with her. I would commit to her, which might sound like a big deal to some other people, but it was a big deal to me. And I asked her if she would maybe have a drink with me or not, whatever. And she said she wouldn't because I wasn't a Christian. And I was just, I couldn't believe it. I'd never heard anything so weird. But then I thought, well, you know, I'm asking some of these big questions and, you know, maybe she'd be interested in me if I turn up at their Christian union. So I did. So I just started going to this Christian union, started meeting Christians that I'd never really met proper Christians before. I'd only seen them on TV and I was really shocked to find they could be intelligent or normal or funny. And then it was the whole, well, it was the Jesus thing that made the difference. It was discovering that there's this guy called Jesus who's really radically progressive, who I thought, man, I could base my life on him. But yeah, that the doorway in many ways was meeting this girl as a kind of, as a way in.
Mm. Well, that's really interesting. I think actually it's, I was talking to a friend the other day and he said that he remembered being five and being all of a sudden just petrified of death. And thought, right, there must be something after this. Like, this can't just be it. Mm. This makes no sense. So he then just took himself off to church by himself. And his parents would drop him off. They weren't interested at all. And so he had quite a similar gateway in that sense where you were talking earlier about being interested in and supernatural things being very real to you in a horror movie or that genre taking that idea very seriously. I just wanted to talk about a little bit about demonology because my understanding is have you got an interest in that or is it just
something? I'm only interested in probably as much as anyone else is. I don't have any kind of qualification in it. There was an article about me in the Daily Star or something and it had like from Britain's leading exorcist.
Right.
Like I'm not even an exorcist, you know. So I really don't
ask it because the Daily Star they're usually so
yeah, they're so accurate. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think actually it's the Daily Sport. It's even more highbrow. But I don't really have experience in that sort of thing, and I'm not qualified in those sorts of things. Although, as a church minister, you do get called to bizarre situations, and I have been called to a few things before. And even now, I mean, even though I'm mainly an author these days, so I speak at churches on Sundays, but I don't look after a congregation. But even now, I'm getting more and more emails from people who are talking about this subject and having strange things happening in their.
But there's a shortage, isn't there? We read there was a shortage of exorcists.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we were talking.
Exorcism is booming at the moment. Yeah. Like, last year it was fidget spinners. This year it's the ancient ritual of exorcism.
Wow.
That everyone seems to be into. No, it's really exploding. And there's some, actually, I think there's some reasonable sociological reasons why it is. But if you're a kind of very hardcore Christian, you might just say, because we're living in much more demonic times.
Yeah.
But actually,
yeah,
there's more kind of nuanced arguments as to why they're growing.
Mm. Well, I noticed in like horror films in recent years have been leaning way more on like on demons and exorcisms and stuff against. Well, obviously The Exorcist came out like years ago, but recently there's been like a new spate of them sort of like films revolving around demons.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Demons.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think maybe and see that again. This was almost for me my way in. I was brought up in a Christian family, but I remember being about 15 and just reading the Bible, and I'm like, well, I'm not seeing any of this. Like, I don't see any of this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any miracles. I'm not seeing any healing. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely not seeing demons. That's definitely not something I'm seeing. And then I experienced some stuff with a couple of friends.
Okay.
And he'd gone through a really traumatic family, like circumstance, and practically started like just calling. Like, I don't know, where I can't remember the language he used, but he basically started like calling on demonic forces to be a part of his life. And then surprise, like I would be talking to him and then like his eyes would just become white. It's just little things like that that grabbed my attention.
Did they become white in a kind of way that was beyond him just looking up high?
Yeah, it was. And I remember being, like you said earlier, I remember being on my own with him and thinking, I'm like, there's no one else here to verify this, but this is definitely happening. And he's not just rolled his eyes back. This is, and this isn't him. He's not behaving like himself.
Yeah.
So I think there's something very real about it. And I wonder whether maybe people are just experiencing stuff like that.
Well, yeah, there was that argument that, and I interviewed a guy called Alan Murdy, who is the chairman of the Ghost Club, but has an interest in sort of the occult and things like that, and occult crimes and that sort of thing. And you talked to him about, like, I was trying to work out the sociology of kind of paranormal interest. Why are we having this boom in paranormal interest in now? And I was coming up with all these theories, which many of which are valid, you know, that were, you know, living in a kind of post-Christian age, and the paranormal interest that offers a really great religious expression for people today, which is, it's exploring the supernatural, but it's using science to kind of get real world results. It's kind of similar to this sort of Victorian spiritualism, which is like a boom today. All these different interesting things. And he said, these are all interesting topics. He says, true, but loads of the people he meets have got no interest in this subject, but then something happens to them and they start getting interested because they're trying to explain it. And I've had that experience where I just talk to people in my own town and they'll say, I'm not interested in this stuff, but something happened to me last night. Something happened here, something happened there. So I find this stuff really intriguing. I do have a kind of cynicism about it, because so often people will describe things that you'll go, oh, you know, you saw a figure at the end of your bed when you were sleeping. Yeah. Come on, that's probably a like sort of hypnagogic hallucination, quite potentially.
Yeah. But or a dream carrying on.
Yeah. Or I went on a ghost walk once where they said, and this house is haunted because they kept losing their keys and the poltergeist was hiding. I was like, oh, come on. So
cheeky poltergeist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I get cynical. But every now and again, a story comes along and you're going, oh, that's maybe harder to explain. Yeah. And this is the where the irony thing comes in, because I find that scary, but I also find it very attractive to want to witness. So the stuff that when you describe that thing about that guy and eyes and stuff, I would find that very disturbing. But if you told me that you knew where he was tonight and you could drive me to his house so I could witness it, I'd say, we're going now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because to see this is to boost faith, I think.
Mm.
But often examples of the supernatural you could explain in some other way. But if I see some dude levitating, or he has some sort of like hidden knowledge. And this is one of the interesting things about exorcism. You know, you've got some of the marks of whether or not a person's really possessed. And so much of it can be fate.
Mm-hmm.
They've got an aversion to religious symbols. All right. Or they're so swearing. Or they've learned a bit of Aramaic off the internet or something. You know, these things can be faked.
Mm.
But there are things like the eye thing. I suppose it's possible that could be faked, but that's harder to fake. Levitation, you can't really fake that unless you're kind of a magician. And then there's this other creepy thing about sort of forbidden knowledge where an exorcist might come in and they'll sit down with a person and they've never met them before. And the person will be saying like, I know why your sister killed herself in 1977. Yeah. And you'd be like, crap, nobody knows about that. That stuff gives me the shivers.
Well, forbidden knowledge is always, like, you said you're a Lovecraft fan. And,
well, yes.
Forbidden knowledge is, exactly, is Lovecraft.
Yeah. But of course, then you could just say, you could explain that by, well, so this is an example of kind of psychic phenomena. That, or they're even to read a person's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't necessarily have to be demonic, but it could be.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, you're talking about that, the experiences like that, just increasing your faith. I talked on episode 2.
Well, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
God, good memory.
And various other, about certain,
it's not about the time you nearly drowned again, is it?
No. We've talked about that too many times. Certain experiences that I've had, in Mozambique and other, African nations where witchcraft is happening, and they're cursing people and they're drinking animals' bloods and they're doing all kind of stuff to make people better, and so it, for me, it was seeing someone levitate. It was,
so did you actually see them?
Yeah, I couldn't explain it, and I thought it was because it was really hot, but there were lots of other people around watching.
And how far off the ground surface was
it? About a foot, a good amount of space.
Did you try any kind of like,
I wasn't directly involved.
Did you bring out
there were eight men, kind of praying for this guy, and so I kind of took myself off. I'm like, for once, I'm going to be a fly on the wall, and kind of watch this going on. And in a way, I kind of wish I hadn't, because it was
I couldn't explain it,
but I just thought, I was like, that's too mad. That's too crazy.
Your brain wasn't ready.
But do you have, like, you know, in terms of your faith, do you have kind of like a bank of experiences that you look back on and go, these are the things that sustain my faith? Like, is that levitation moment one of those experiences?
That I do now. Now I look back on that, and that's my bank of experience. Because then after about 20 minutes of prayer and stuff going on, he was quote-unquote fine. And he was behaving, and he seemed like a completely different man. Like when we met him, it was almost like he was carrying a weight on him. And you could almost sense like a weighty presence.
Yeah.
You know, when you meet some people sometimes and they just feel like they're pulling life out of you. It felt like that.
Psychic
and then all
vampires,
of a sudden,
I've heard them described as. Yeah.
So I feel like now I have that bank of experience. But I think that was my first, and albeit quite a strong experience.
Because I think there is a hunger for the supernatural today. And I'm sort of surprised that the church doesn't play on this more, you know, because it was incredibly supernatural faith. But in many ways, churches feel like the most unsupernatural places you can be on the planet, because they will often kind of deny some of these things, or they'll, particularly in movies, you know, you'll see like an exorcism and the family will go to the church to ask for help. And they'll be kind of the most rational people in the whole film. Because the church is saying, no, we need evidence, we do that. They've got good reason to do this, because they don't want to get locked up for a false exorcism. But ironically, I'm not surprised people are looking for the supernatural experiences in other places, because there are other churches. I mean, there's a church up the road in Bedford who, like, I know at the moment they're reporting crazy stuff going on. I don't know what that's about, but people find that scary but attractive.
It's definitely like the interest in the paranormal and the supernatural is definitely like seems to have risen over the last couple of years.
Yeah, belief in ghosts is up over the last 10 years.
It's on the rise.
Yeah, it's on the rise. Yeah.
Ghosts hot.
Yeah, ghosts are so hot right now. Wow. Yeah. But I mean, I suppose talking about exorcism, I'd want to really put in a kind of proviso and a caution, is that it's an incredibly dangerous area. And I don't necessarily mean in the kind of religious sense. I mean in the mental health sense.
Mm-hmm.
It is so easy to misdiagnose someone with mental health issues as having a demon. And that can be incredibly damaging to a person. And I know reports of people who've had epilepsy when they're younger and their parents have tried to exorcise them.
Right.
And the labeling that they've had, or Tourette's syndrome or alien hand syndrome and all these other things, or schizophrenia. So actually, I am incredibly, incredibly cautious. And that's why the church is cautious on these things. You can't just go out and exorcise someone. But there's a growing kind of wild west of indie demonologists on the scene who just go out and kind of do the biz. Bob Larson is one of the most famous ones. I don't know if you know about him, but he'll do your exorcism via Skype.
Right. Okay.
And his daughters, he's got these like Buffy the Vampire Slayer looking type daughters who go out and they do exorcisms and they're like teen exorcists.
I read about these guys.
Yeah. I saw a documentary on
them. That's right. Yeah. I did too.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not saying that it's all crap. A lot of it looks like it, but it's just, it's such a crazy area. But what's interesting is some of the people, even if it's not even demonic, some people actually find the prospect of being possessed by a demon more attractive than having a mental health label put on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you sit down at the doctor's and the doctor says, well, sorry, Mr. Laws, but you've got schizophrenia, if they diagnose you like that, you'll think, oh, crap, that's me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's almost like my fault. I remember when I was at school growing up, and if I had a spot on my nose or something, or I had acne, I'd be thinking, crap, that's my fault.
Yeah.
You know, I caused that. It made me feel crap about myself. But then if I got an accident, somebody threw a ball at my face, I could have the same blemish, but it's someone else's fault.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, oh, well, that's fine. That's not me. And so interestingly, with demonology and all this sort of stuff, there can be an attraction in saying, well, no, it's not a mental health issue. It's a demon.
Yeah.
Because that demon is separate from who I am. So I can hate the thing inside myself, but it's not me.
Mm.
And there's a ritual available who can get rid of it. And I'll be back to normal again.
And we've talked about the stigma that people have towards like anything, mental health issues. There's like a stigma. Yeah. So if there's something to blame, then it makes it so much easier.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. There's less stigma, I think, for some people to have a demon than it is to have depression.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the great thing is like, say you can get rid of it. And once it's gone, if you're in a religious community, people can go, oh, well, I'll just accept you as who you are because that's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Very difficult for a person who's diagnosed as schizophrenic to say, oh, that's gone now.
Yeah.
Because people think, oh, no, that's with you for life. So I think that explains why there is a growth in, one of the reasons why there is such a growth in people valuing and seeking this out.
And so obviously now you're very busy with your books, but has that been something that's been a part of your life? Obviously as a minister, have you been involved in exorcisms and or in maybe not exorcisms, we maybe wouldn't label it that way, but have you been involved in many cases where that's...
I've had experiences where I've been called to places to sort of to pray for people who were experiencing some sort of oppression and even with voices and things like that.
Mm.
But every time I've done that, I've encouraged the person to go to a GP and get checked out, and I've sort of kept the door open to the rational explanation as well.
Mm.
I haven't been called to places where I've had to do kind of a full on, you know, go around with holy water and things. I've had experiences where I've just gone to somebody's house to do something different. Like say a couple wanted to get married. And so I went around their house and I was talking to them about marriage preparation classes if they wanted to get married.
Yeah.
And I was just saying, oh, well, you know, it's probably a good idea if you guys are on the same page with certain subjects like, you know, money, sex, all these sorts of things. So, you know, should we talk about that stuff before you got married? And I prayed with them that night just about general stuff. And then a few days later, she got in touch and she said, thank you so much for praying, because since you prayed, the figure that comes in my room, in my son's room at night, tell him bad things, it stopped since you did that. So there's things where, you know, even through accident, I may have been involved in something. But I've never really been called out properly. I have had people who've asked and explained the situation, and it's like, that's beyond me. And I've passed them on to other people.
Right.
So there are some crazy shenanigans going on in the world at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would be really refreshing for some of our listeners to hear, actually. And I always wonder as a Christian whether people outside of the church are maybe thinking, are Christians maybe becoming a bit more rational? Like you said, looking for the rational side of things. So when you said that you would often advise people to go to a GP, I think that's only going to do good things for the church, because I think historically the church has been way too cautious. I remember talking to my grandparents last year, and they were telling me that they remember being in church in the 60s, when Jimi Hendrix was all the rage, and the message that many, many churches were giving out to people were, we are not having electric guitars in the church because they're demonic.
Mm.
And so my grandparents now look back in hindsight and laugh because that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I think, I wonder whether the church has fallen foul too many times, in just kind of maybe being a bit too cautious or a bit too ill-educated or not really thinking about things, or, you know, and you can understand it if they may be looking to the Bible. Mm. That's what they've been doing with their lives. But, so I think that'd be really refreshing for people to hear that that's, yeah, that's the way you've approached.
Yeah. And you don't want, to kind of like rule out the supernatural explanation, or rule it in up without thought. So you keep both doors open, but you really do have to be cautious with this, because you're talking about people's lives here, you know, and then to get labeled that you've got a demon, that's not just something you can, and this is the scary thing. Like, people are doing this, and particularly with, there's certain churches, some African churches, obviously not all, but this, one of the reasons why it's growing is because of the different kind of, different cultures coming into to Britain, which is brilliant. You know, I'm all for that. But on a religious level, what's interesting is they may come from countries where it's just much more natural to say, you know, if you're ill, or if you're, you know, you've lost your job, it may be a result of a curse, or a witchcraft curse, or a demon, and so therefore the solutions will have a kind of demonic level to it, you know. Whereas in Britain, that's not a normal thing for people to think. It certainly does happen, but caution is required.
So Tis, picked up my phone. Tis messaged us. He was like, if you're still talking, he had a question because he can't be here.
Oh, right, yeah.
So this is a bit convoluted, though, because it's kind of...
Are you having to translate from
kind
this?
Of. Tis can be difficult. But
it's all those mushrooms you've done.
Ah, I see. I've been there.
Right. So, this is actually kind of apt because we're just talking about mental health and stuff, but are you aware of the philosopher Eckhart Tolle and his theory on pain bodies?
Pain bodies?
Yeah.
No, I'm
right. Okay. So,
do tell.
Pain bodies are a thing that he says we have in us that we feed by giving negative energy and it will bring us down. So you feed your pain body. Right. And the idea is that you don't indulge in these negative things that would feed your pain body. So it just quells into nothing and you're a positive person. That's a very sort of quick way to put it. He did a whole like 2-hour episode on it. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, he wondered what your opinion on Eckhart Tolle's view that horror movies are apparently designed by pain bodies for pain bodies. Pain bodies being the part of us that feed off negative energy and weigh us down. He would say that the horror genre should not be watched to keep a balanced mind and not feed this pain body.
I disagree. I think that's an exercise in denying humanity. Mm-hmm. The pain body, if it's a thing, or if you wanted to call it that, is part of who we are. And I don't think we should be trying to deny part of ourselves. We shouldn't learn how to control it or not allow it to spill over into real life. Mm-hmm. But to try and sort of edge it out and try and keep it away, I think that's where kind of madness lies. I know that Jung would talk about the kind of balance between sort of the shadow self and ourselves as being that's the balance. You know, you try and find a balance between those two things, but you have to accept those things and know that it's part of you. I think what horror films do, they do feed that dark side of you, but in a way that's absolutely safe. And that's what's good about them. And so they prevent us, I think, in many ways from exercising some of our violent tendencies because we have in a cathartic nature. And I think you see this particularly in the kind of in video games. Yes. The argument with video games being that it's programming teenagers to turn into school shooters. But actually, you know, if you look at the lifespan of video games from the late 70s to now, really by now, we should have an epidemic of youth crime because we've all been programmed by these video games. And you've seen the opposite. You've seen youth crime drop drastically.
Yeah, because it's kind of like an outlet for that aggression or a way to relax and ebb out those feelings, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And to deny those, to get to push this pain body away and never feed it, I think that all you're doing is creating a ravenous monster who's hungry.
Pain monster.
And who will want to feed in some way. Mm. And so I think that the key to balance is acknowledging both sides and just finding healthy ways of dealing with it. Mm. And I think like I think human beings are amazing at how we have created safe environments in which to kill each other. I just think this is a really clever thing. And it's progress. Yeah. I think the fact that you can watch a film like Saw, where someone is like graphically sawing someone's head off, right? That is progress. And I say that because there was a time when in ancient Rome, we would all be together and going, way, and you get your cathartic nature out of seeing someone chop someone's head off in real life.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore, but we're humans and we understand that we do need still to ponder death. And to not think about death, and to not think about suffering and what could happen to our bodies because we're physical beings, I think is absolutely absurd.
Well, I talked about it on the first Fear episode where I said, like, I don't think it's healthy to deny any emotion. Like, we have a whole spectrum of emotions. You can't just say, well, no, that one's a bad one, so you don't feel that emotion and take it away. It's like, okay, I'm not a spiritual person, but if someone is and you believe that the humans are created with this many features and stuff, why would we be given a feature that we're not allowed to use?
Yeah.
Like, is it to test us? Is it that I think all your emotions should be given like an equal weight. You know, some are negative emotions. They do serve a positive purpose.
Yeah, of course they do. Yeah. I think when we looked at this with Tis before, so I've been a youth pastor for 5 years, stepping down in the summer. I get my Fridays.
Oh, are
you? Yeah, we're doing 20s, 30s stuff.
Oh, but I didn't know.
Yeah, that's so fun. Moving up.
Is this in Milton Keynes, is it?
Aylesbury.
Oh, you're Aylesbury.
Right? Yeah. But we've been, we felt for a while that is the right thing to do. But, and this is something that always comes up with our youth. Some parents, and I do get it, you know, parents are going to be cautious of their kids playing things or looking at things, whatever, I get that. But some teenagers always say to us, can I watch this particular movie or this particular genre of music or something? And my answer has always been that I can't tell you what to do. And I think you have to find for yourself what works for you.
Yeah.
You know, I remember talking about violence in video games. I remember playing GTA 5.
Yeah.
There's a moment in the game where you're playing as Trevor and you're torturing someone.
Yeah, I remember that bit well.
And
plying somebody's tooth out.
Yeah. And to begin with, I was thinking, I was like, this is interesting part of a game.
Yeah.
And then after a while, I caught myself enjoying it and I was like, I'm enjoying this.
But just, I think you should just enjoy it. I really enjoyed that game.
To begin with, it caught me off guard. And then I think I just kind of thought, no. But I remember watching, I remember watching Donnie Darko when that came out.
Oh, yeah.
And loving it and thinking, this is a really great, very different movie. And then I lent it to a friend who had just become a Christian off of the back of something like 9 or 10 years addiction to heroin.
Oh, okay.
Right. So I lent it to him and I said, after about a week, I said, did you watch it? And he said, yeah, I threw it in the bin, man. And I went, what? Threw my DVD in the bin. And he went, yeah, you should be watching that stuff. He says, that's crazy demonic stuff going on. He said, I was watching it and I just found myself going to a very dark place again. Mm. And I said, okay, so then give it back to me and say, I don't want to watch it again.
Yeah.
But just because for you,
saving the world from it
didn't work.
Doesn't
mean it's going to be the same for everyone. And I think it's, you know, me and my wife are a classic example of this. You know, I can watch horror movies to a point and then go to bed and I'm going to be fine. My wife, her imagination is too, like, we'll watch Friends or something so dull and then go to bed and she'll dream about it. So she can't watch horror movies because, or something. Like this happened the other night. Like we were watching Friends and then Ross was in her dream. Not about Friends, just was in the dream.
Just hanging out with Ross.
Yeah.
Ross was her friend.
So I get why maybe she might not want to watch horror movies.
But I think that's okay. And I think it's all down to ourselves to self-regulate, you know. And some people's thresholds are lower than others. And I completely respect that. But what I do struggle with is a very fundamental misunderstanding, which when I played GTA 5 and I remember that exact scene, and this was before I'd thought about this stuff in depth, I felt exactly the same way. I was thinking, flipping heck, like I'm literally torturing this guy and it's kind of fun, but it feels bad.
Yeah.
And especially as a Christian, I shouldn't do this. And then later on, and I've particularly writing this Frighteners book, I just thought, hang on a minute. Why are we equating fake violence with real violence. Mm. That's so completely not the same thing. Like, it sounds obvious, but there are two completely different things. Mm-hmm. And so you think, well, hang on a minute. Did that prompt you to want to go and do that to someone for real? No. Did it give you a sense of enjoyment because you were doing it in a fake way? Yeah. Mm. That doesn't mean you want to do it to someone real. Mm. And the danger, I think, is when you start feeding the conspiracy theory in your head that, crap, maybe I do want to do this.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's
when
the
you
danger.
Start labeling, you have these self-fulfilling prophecies and you start labeling yourself as, and so I worry more about teenagers who play video games who basically will enjoy playing a video game and then their parents or their pastors or their teachers are saying, why on earth do you want to shoot people?
You're sick.
You're sick. And the kid starts thinking, wow, am I? And, or why is there so much blood in video games? Often it's just for a strategic reason because you have to be able to tell who you've shot. You know, like you have to clearly be able to know which person you've shot and then you can shoot the next person. Mm. It's not all up. Most kids who play video games, they're not drawn to the gore as much as they are to the strategy, to the atmosphere, to the story. Bit of blood here and there. Mm. It's no big deal. So I think it's far more dangerous actually to start labeling kids. And I talk about this in the book about how, particularly with little kids and playing like with toy guns at school, we're in danger of screwing kids up when we say picking up a stick and going pew pew means they've got problems. But kids are getting expelled. Suspended from school for doing that now.
Really?
I got cases in America where that's happening.
Yeah, it's like you're not allowed to have imagination.
Yeah.
I read the book The Frighteners and I found that chapter really interesting. My girlfriend's mum works in a primary school. So I talked about it a lot with her and she pretty much came down on the same side as you did with that chapter. Like, interesting. She's like, exactly, kids should be allowed to have like an imagination. It's, you know, you don't stifle their creativity and stuff. Mm. Just because it's, you know, he's got a gun doesn't mean he's going to grow up to want a real gun and shoot everyone and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
But if he grows up or she grows up, the kid feeling isolated and unconnected and not having any kind of really strong sort of social cohesion with their peers, that's when the danger starts.
Exactly.
And that's when the isolation starts.
You start alienating the person, they're going to feel alienated.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then along with the alienation, you feed them with another lie, which is, you know, you're only a significant person unless you're famous and you're a celebrity. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, I take my anger and I take my desire for significance to be famous. I'll go and shoot somebody. That actually is a very logical way of responding, but it's great. Like, it's not the way to do it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be the way.
Yeah.
I'm going to start wrapping because we've been going a long time.
I haven't realised.
But yeah, I do want to bring up the Frighteners, the book. I thought we'd talk about it more, but we just got chatting about stuff. But I recently read it. We went to the book launch in Milton Keynes a couple months ago.
Yeah, it's nice to see you there.
Yeah, it was really good. So I definitely recommend listeners to pick up a copy. And basically, like, each chapter is kind of a mini investigation into different genres of horror with different, little experiments and excursions you went on, which is really fun, like framing device to dig a bit deeper into these things. Also, I have a bone to pick with you.
Yeah, go.
There's a chapter where you talk about vampires and vampirism. And there's a section about the sanguinarians. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And they like, they want to drink blood.
Yeah, they literally do drink blood. Yeah.
I found that a bit so disgusting.
Found that. She said she struggled to get through that. It didn't really bother me, but she found it appalling.
Oh, there's bits where you're talking about how they do it and I like cut the thing and they draw blood from the vein. And I was just like, I was eating my breakfast reading that bit and I was like, oh, God.
Because it is an offensive. Sometimes when you catch yourself, like you catch your lip or you get a hangnail and you sort of like you just kind of like, wow, it doesn't taste
warming up in the microwave for, you know, a couple of seconds to get, so it's nice and warm.
That is the life and all that. But I suppose, like, because what I was trying to do with that book is literally just trying to answer the question to myself is, well, look, you know, I'm actually a fairly reasonably well-adjusted, nice guy. You know, I don't want to hurt anyone. I hate that stuff. I get disturbed by violence. So why do I like this stuff in real life? And I really come to the conclusion that I am trying to deal with my own fears of death and suffering by taking the things that scare me and putting them into controllable ways, which we kind of talked about before. And I'm normally a novelist, so I normally write novels.
Yes.
That's my kind of main thing. And in those, they're scary and they're dark. And they also are opportunities for me to take scary things, the furniture that scares me, and put them in a ways that I'm in control of. And so to me, it's quite natural to do that.
Yeah.
And as a Christian, it's been a slow journey to come to the conclusion. But now I'd say as a Christian, and people out there, if they're Christians or not, but particularly for Christians, you often are told that you are a freak. And there are a lot of lonely Christians out there who like this stuff and are feeling that there's something wrong with them. And I just want to say, you are absolutely normal, human, everyday people. And this is who we are. And you don't have to kind of push away your bad self or whatever.
Fit into the mold.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, don't if it's slipping over into actual killing people, maybe that's a bit,
you've
gone a bit too far.
I feel like it feels to me like a generational thing. You know, when maybe, I got my tattoo, my grandparents.
Oh, really?
You know, as, you know, full-blown Christians, been Christians all their lives.
Yeah.
Because that was their teaching.
They thought you had a demon in you.
No, not at all. And I think, I was like, look, I've got there's the Bible. But I think because of that teaching, but I think maybe now Christians are becoming more progressive.
Well, I think they are in lots of different ways, from the classics of same-sex marriage and all that sort of stuff. More and more people are getting a bit more chilled out about these hot topics, which not that long ago would have been, you know, deal breakers, evolution.
And illegal, actually.
Illegal, of course.
50 years ago isn't that long, really.
Actually, it reminded me just, you mentioned demons again, there was an experience when I was younger, which actually is the basis of my second novel. And you mentioned Donnie Darko as well, because that reminds me of that. In the second novel is basically about the main character is a atheist ex-church minister who helps the police solve religiously motivated crime. Mm. And in the second novel, he's on the trail of what looks like a serial killer, but everyone else is saying could actually be some sort of demonic black rabbit figure that is killing people. And that was actually based on an experience when I was a teenager, when me and my friends, we used to go on ghost hunts, and we sort of hopped the fence and broke into this old kind of sanatorium, and we were going around there, and I looked up and I saw this strange tall black rabbit standing on, like a man, you know, standing on top of the roof and looking down at us. And me and my friends ran away, and it was really scary. And ran on the corner, I looked back and I saw this kind of figure come out of behind the wall and was sort of rocking from side to side like this, like almost that's like horrible. A monkey or something would. And it was scary, right? So I went home, wrote all this down, and I was thrilled by it, but I was scared. And then later on, when I became a Christian, I remember I went into I'd been a Christian for a year, and I was going through some emotional turmoil with some things that happened in my past. And I thought, well, I think I'll talk to the minister about it. And I spoke to the minister, and he said, I think you need to come in and pray with me and this other person. And I did, and it was a very intense, I've never had this experience. It was almost, you know, like an exorcism, but it was crazy. It was so big. And I was explaining all the different Ouija boards I'd done over my time and all these seances and ghost hunts. And he said, it's interesting you say that. I didn't tell him about this rabbit thing, but he says, it's interesting you say that, Peter, because the reason I wanted to pray with you is because when you turned up at the church, when I spoke to you, I wanted to pray with you because I could see this black tall figure standing next to you. And I thought it would be important that we prayed. So that's why I was so urgent. And I was like, okay, right. Week after that, I used to be in bands, and that randomly I was singing at some weird talent show in Blackpool the weekend. And I was doing these crazy sort of, you know, lounge Las Vegas type stuff. Start spreading the news, all this sort of crazy. There was big money involved. I thought I could win a big pot of cash. And I went to the hotel room that night, and I saw it. I saw it in my room coming toward me. And I don't know if it was a hallucination or what. I was fed by all of this information.
Like a manifestation of your fears.
Fears or an actual demonic presence, I don't know. But I've always been fascinated by that scenario, especially because it happened to me when I was a teenager. And then when I was in my 20s, it sort of returned. And it was a cool idea anyway. So it ended up being the topic of my second novel. But that's what I like about this subject.
Yeah.
You can rationalize it, but if you leave the door open to possibility, that is where the thrill lies, I think.
Yeah. And if you leave the door open when you're watching a film about serial killers, it adds a bit of spice as well.
Yeah,
better. Intense horrors.
Okay, great. Like I said, definitely recommend picking up The Frighteners. And there's going to be links and stuff on the website to various things like we always put up. Yeah, any stuff you want to plug, like go ahead now.
Yeah, follow me on social media, folks, at Rev Peter Laws at Twitter and Instagram, peterlaws.co.uk. My novels are out now, Purged and Unleashed. I've just submitted the third one, and they come with bizarre soundtracks too. So,
awesome,
amazing.
So, available on audio cassette for the retro people, but also digital download as well. But yeah, and I write a column for the 14 Times magazine, so I'm their regular horror guy. Which is amazing. I just kept getting free pre-release horror movies.
Oh, that's great.
That's really good.
It's living the dream.
Great gig.
If only your teenage self would have known that.
I know.
Horror films.
Yeah. Praise the Lord, I say.
Okay, well, cool. Thanks so much for letting us talk to you. It's been really, like, really great, interesting conversation.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
No, really thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
So I'm just jumping in here to do a little bit of the housekeeping stuff. You can go on the website weirdtalesandtheunexplainable.com. You can go on there, you can find links to all the social media places. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook. You can contact us, find a blog post for every episode, including this one, with links and information to all the things we've talked about, including information on more of Peter Law's books, which we definitely recommend. You can also contact us directly at unexplainableuk@mail.com. So there's a little bit more of the show left, just a little bit of conversation that me, Beef, and Peter had towards the end of the recording session. We talk a little bit more about The Frighteners and about Halloween.
Ah, cool. No, it was a good conversation. Covered a lot of ground.
It was really fun.
It was really good.
Really good.
Thank you. It's such an interesting topic. I mean, you could talk all night.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a million things I could talk about.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, there's loads of stuff. And I suppose particularly with a book like that, because there's like, you know, there's all like zombies and then there's like vampire stuff and the werewolves. So there's lots of different topics, but I think we covered some good ground.
Yeah, it was really good. Yeah, it was great.
But the book was great. I really enjoyed reading it. Mm. I loved the different framing devices, like having a different chapter to each subject. Okay, once I'd read a bit about, you know, Murderabilia, then next I'm going to read a bit about vampires, and it's like, oh, okay, it changed, like, it's really interesting, really fun.
It's almost
fun
like a collection of short stories in a way.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Like mini essays.
It felt really, particularly because I love reading, but I don't devote enough time to it. I'd love to read more. So it's normally that bit before I go to bed.
Yeah.
So it was nice to have that bit before I go to bed.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Get a chapter.
Yeah, it's a good response. It comes out in America in a couple of months. Was it September? So
I was going to ask you about that.
See how
actually.
It goes down.
Still recording, so I can include any of this in the show.
Sure.
Still. But do you find with the US release, like, I feel like this isn't really a topic. I just think there's a real difference in the interest from like US audience and UK audience in terms of like the paranormal and stuff, because it seems always to have been like a popular subject over there. Do you know what I mean? But not so much here.
Yeah, like particularly with Halloween.
They're very drawn to the spooky and the supernatural in a way that maybe we're not so much over there.
Mm.
Yeah. I didn't know if that changed the way it was going to be promoted in the US or.
I think that the US publishers have just said that it has this subject does have broad appeal, and I had a conversation with them on the phone the other day, and they said because of the Christian side of it, that will particularly be interesting to people.
Yeah,
and so like in Britain, it just says Peter Laws on the cover. Mm-hmm. In America, it says Reverend Peter Laws because they want to pick that part up. Whereas in Britain, that could easily put people off, so they want to kind of make that sinister minister link there. And she said, you know, well, the book may not find itself in some sort of like mom and pop like little store in the middle of kind of Idaho or something, but she says in all like definitely it'll be on the shelves in all of the kind of the hip places, you know, like New York, LA,
because it's such an interest
that's
for that
great
stuff over there.
Yeah, and people are interested in this sort of thing. I think that's quite interesting. And then the novels come out in Germany
at
the end of this year.
Are the novels out in the US as well?
No, they're available in the US, but they haven't got a separate deal in the US.
Right, okay.
Slightly different setup.
Yeah. So, like, that's what made me think of, like, the interest in the US is so much greater.
Mm.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they've got such, like, huge, diverse audiences there, but this sort of stuff just does they're still with them. And yeah, I mean, they've had such a kind of a healthy relationship with Halloween for a long time. And so like in Britain, we're just kind of getting on board with the whole scare attraction stuff, but they've had that stuff.
Well, they have like the big haunted house like events, and there's like, you know, you pay to get in, there's this many haunted houses and they're all themed. And yeah, it definitely hasn't increased over the years.
It's definitely, I mean, really only the last few years, Halloween's become this.
It's big, a big deal, isn't it? It's like,
We went out last year, but mainly because we were like, I can't be bothered with the door.
You just don't put a
we put some sweets out.
Come for the sweets,
and then we went to the kids next door and gave them some sweets.
Right, okay.
And they're like, we're going out. And then I think the year before Joel wasn't born, we went to the cinema. Like, let's just go out.
Oh, right, yeah.
Did you see a horror film?
No, not with Rachel.
No, silly question.
Okay, that really is the end of the episode now. So thanks again to Peter Laws. It was really interesting conversation. Really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. There's another episode of Weird Tales coming soon. It's already been recorded. It should be up in the next few weeks. I just need to do a little bit of editing on it. It's me and a guest host on a mini adventure. That's all I'll say for now. So until next time. No, I'm not doing a pun. See ya.
I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.